Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 20th, 2026, we are delighted to host this discussion entitled Looper Bright Fallout for SEC Rulemaking. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Peggy Little and Jan Falena as our speakers, and Michael Pivovar as our moderator. Mr. Pivovar is Executive Vice President of Milken Institute Finance and served as a commissioner at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission from 2013 to 2018. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that the questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mike, the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. It's my pleasure to moderate this discussion on how the 2024 Supreme Court decision in Loper Bright has already changed behavior at the Securities and Exchange Commission and how the decision will continue to shape the SEC and other regulatory agency behavior in the future. I'm so pleased that we have two outstanding experts on SEC rulemaking and enforcement actions, as well as broader questions of administrative law. Before we get started, a couple of housekeeping announcements. First, this webinar is not open to the press, but it will be posted publicly on FedSoc websites and channels. We're looking forward to an open and frank discussion, not just among the three of us, but also to incorporate questions from you all in the audience. On that note, as Matthew mentioned, if you'd like to ask a question for our distinguished speakers, please use the Q&A function in Zoom. And please submit questions as soon as you think of them. I'll be monitoring the chat throughout the webinar, and there may be good opportunities to ask them as we go along in our discussion instead of waiting until the end for the formal Q&A. So with that, let's go ahead and get started with our first speaker, Jan Falena, partner and co-chair of Securities and Regulatory Enforcement at Stradley Ronan. Jan, you successfully secured the dismissal of all charges brought against two mutual fund independent trustees by the SEC in its first enforcement action brought pursuant to Rule 22E4 of the Investment Company Act of 1940, the so-called liquidity rule. Tell us about that case. What was the basis of your challenge, and how did you rely on the Loper Bright decision?
Thanks, Michael. Welcome, everybody. Sure. You know, great question. So the case, just a little bit of background. The case was filed by the SEC against two independent trustees of a mutual fund, which is quite unheard of, even in the most aggressive commission. It was filed under Chair Gensler's commission, so in keeping with the aggressive enforcement posture. But even this was a lot, and I think it really shook the investment management industry, in particular, the number of individuals that are sitting on both mutual fund boards and exchange-traded fund boards. The idea that they could be sued by the SEC under a brand new rule to regulate the liquidity in a mutual fund or an ETF was quite alarming. So the SEC also sued the investment advisor that was Pinnacle. So the name of the case, SEC versus Pinnacle et al. So Pinnacle was the investment advisor. There were two portfolio managers that were sued in the case and the entire board. So the two independent trustees and the interested trustee. Prior to filing, the interested trustee settled and everybody else chose to litigate. The litigation started with motions to dismiss by everybody, and the independent trustees had really two very good arguments. One was the SEC charged them with aiding and abetting the fund's violation of the liquidity rule. So that means that they must have taken some action to assist the fund in violating the rule. However, the SEC's complaint argued that they did nothing. So in other words, gone fishing sign on the door, sitting on our hands, not doing anything about what the SEC viewed to be an asset that was not properly categorized as illiquid. Instead, the fund categorized it as less liquid. That mattered to the commission. And really, the whole reason this case was filed is because categorizing that one asset as less liquid allowed the fund to come in under the 15% rule. So mutual funds are supposed to remain under 15% illiquid assets. This asset would push it over the 15% if it was categorized as illiquid, and that's what the SEC wanted it to do. So there were a number of things at play here. One, determination of asset liquidity is an opinion. And the fact that the SEC disagrees with the fund is not a case under Omnicare. Secondly, aiding and abetting requires some action. The case was filed in the Northern District of New York, so we're in the Second Circuit, where the case law was clear that doing nothing is not aiding and abetting. So we moved on that. And then you have a brand new rule, which, you know, if you're working as a defense counsel in SEC actions, you have to look at the rule. You have to look at whether it was properly promulgated. So that was the second argument we made the first time around in briefing the rule. And we didn't make an argument that there was no notice and comment. We didn't make an argument on cost-benefit analysis. It was straight statutory interpretation. The Investment Company Act of 1940 simply does not permit the SEC to make a rule on liquidity. And at the time we first briefed the case, the law was Chevron. So the first prong of Chevron is if the statute's clear, the inquiry stops. The second prong was, if it's not clear, we defer to the agency's interpretation. Interestingly, the SEC did not argue Chevron deference the first time around by name. Instead, what they relied on is the adopting release to the rule, which everybody knows is 200, 300, sometimes 400 pages of policy arguments about why the rule is appropriate with reference to statutory provisions, but no explanation as to why those statutory provisions allow the rule to be promulgated. So the liquidity rule was no different. Hence, we did argue that the SEC was not entitled to the deference in their policy arguments and that the plain language is clear and we should win. That was in 2023. The case sat. The Supreme Court granted cert in Loper-Bright, and everyone knew Chevron deference was pretty much going down. Waiting for that decision to come out, it comes out, Chevron deference is gone. The judge in the Northern District of New York issues an order that says, you know, the enforcement of this rule is dispositive on the entire case. Loper-Bright is a major change in how we are to look at statutes, in particular when you're litigating against the agency that's administering the statute. So I would like this entire argument rebriefed considering Loper-Bright. So we did that. And it's interesting because Loper-Bright was important and there was a lot of good language in there, namely that you defer to the canons of statutory interpretation. And that's where the whole inquiry starts and stops. And we did that. But there was a progeny of cases leading up to Loper-Bright that really assisted us. One was West Virginia versus EPA, United States versus Bittner, the Santander case, and the list goes on. In the meantime, three other SEC rules had been struck down, both in the D.C. Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, and the Northern District of Texas, all extremely helpful language that allowed us to really put together a brief that was written not just for the court, but for the SEC, which was now under the control of Chair Atkins, who certainly understand these arguments, assisted by Commissioners Peirce and Ojeda, who both voted against amendments to the liquidity rule very recently. And after we had initially briefed the matter, the Investment Company Institute issued a letter indicating to the SEC, we don't think this rule is properly promulgated. So against that backdrop, we filed a brief and resulted in the SEC simply dismissing the case against all parties.
With
okay,
prejudice.
Great. Peggy, go ahead. Yeah. With just prejudice. With,
yeah, that's important.
Yeah. And Peggy, before I go to you, Jan, so you basically won the case. You got it dismissed with prejudice on there or whatever. But what's the status of the rule? We'll come back to what needs to happen in the future. But is it still on the books or did they vacate it or what?
It's still on the books. It is on the books. And what I know from, working in asset management at my law firm, it's still being examined during exams. We've seen a deficiency letter or two on the liquidity rule. And we have not seen anybody referred to enforcement on the liquidity rule. But at least in my view, it's unenforceable, even though the SEC is using it or reviewing it during exams and may actually be raising some issues around it. It's largely, I would think, not enforceable at this point.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll, if we have time, we'll return to that, sort of what the SEC could do and what they actually should do. But I want to bring in Peggy Little, who's senior counsel at the National Civil Liberties Alliance, NCLA, which describes itself as a public interest law firm that challenges the administrative state. I would characterize it as the public interest law firm that challenges the administrative state. And when I think of Peggy, the word relentless comes to mind for two reasons. One, because the word describes her approach to her work. She's relentless in challenging overreaches by the administrative state, but the word also has special meaning for her in the context of today's discussion. So Peggy, first, please tell us about the relentless case. How is it related to Loper Bright and what was your role in it?
Well, I should say it's my colleagues who have the role in the relentless case, which was the companion case to Loper Bright. We like to think of it as the relentless case, but they were combined and they raised the same challenges. And so the victory overturning Chevron deference happened in a case that's also called relentless. And my colleagues, John Vecchione, Mark Chenoweth, and Kara Rollins represented the fishermen in those cases. But I also like to think I'm relentless, and I've been doing some other work as well. But yes, that is a New Civil Liberties Alliance's victory. And I think Jen did a great job talking about, how just taking the agency to task. And I believe, Jen, you told me that the SEC didn't even want you to file your brief. Is that correct?
That's correct. I got a call the Friday before the brief was due on Monday asking me to stand down and not file the brief that the court had ordered because I think they knew what was coming.
Right.
And, you really, I think times have significantly changed, Peggy. The days are gone where everybody stands down and lets the SEC drive the train. I think the industry is driving the train and for good reason. There's so much of the federal securities laws that's still uncertain and can and should be litigated. And I think we're getting, clients are realizing that.
So I think Pinnacle is remarkable for two reasons. First, you need a case, Loper Bright relentless, that overturned decades of deference. And second, you need a judge interested in applying it. And when you get those two things, what do you get from the agency? Capitulation, or please don't even file the brief. Yeah. I think this is a really important thing for people to understand. The agencies would prefer, at least in some instances, total surrender rather than risk a precedential decision that would in any way contract their power. Now, we are encountering this this problem in a much larger context, and I want to approach this topic from a generalist point of view because New Civil Liberties Alliance's mission is to look at these problems across agencies, across industries, and we also represent individuals, otherwise known as low-hanging fruit, which often serve as the first targets of enforcement. And I'm going to give you four recent examples where the agency deflection of a decision has come into play. The first is one I'm looking at right now, the Consolidated Audit Trail, which is a completely unprecedented and totally unauthorized scheme in which the SEC collects data on every single trade made by every single investing American in every securities market. We have challenged that in the Western District of Texas, and the SEC has now filed two requests for what will amount to over a year's abeyance of any decision in the case so that they can engage in a, quote, comprehensive rethink of the case. We think comprehensive rethink is actually a futile attempt to move the lawsuit, and there's no way anything the SEC can do to authorize what is an unauthorized program. There's no authority under the 34 Act or any other statute that allows us, the SEC, to do this. Attorney General William Barr has described it as the greatest Fourth Amendment violation he has encountered. Here's another one. Many of you may be familiar with a case called Axon Cochrane, and that case overturned, the Supreme Court unanimously overturned six circuit courts of appeal, which had prohibited people from going into district court to challenge administrative agency adjudication. Axon itself spent 5 years and $22 million fighting the SEC over the FTC over this unconstitutional internal agency adjudication. And what happened when they got the right to go into court and challenge it? The FTC quietly withdrew the case and did not even tell Axon it was doing so, and thus ended with a whimper Axon's descent into the administrative state. SEC outdid the FTC when Michelle Cochran won her case, which was part of Axon. So the Axon and Cochran are linked just the same way that Loper Bright and Relentless are linked. Justice Gorsuch noted that she had fought the SEC for 7 years. Just 6 weeks after she won the right to go into federal court and challenge the constitutionality of her adjudication, the SEC dismissed not only her case, but all 42 of its open administrative cases. This sent shockwaves through the financial press. It also, not only did the SEC drop cases, and some of them presumably meritorious, it did so because it did not want to have its agency adjudication challenged in court where it might get an adverse decision. Also, in Michelle Cochran's case, there had been something called a control deficiency, where the enforcement staff had been accessing the ALJ files. Once you dismiss the case, you cannot get judicial discovery on that, and our FOIA requests have gone unanswered now for over 4 years. Also, NCLA set aside the SEC's board diversity rule, in which it presumed under its power to approve NASDAQ rules, the power to tell American corporations what the composition of their board should be along racial, sexual orientation, and gender lines. And we were able to secure a ruling at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, setting aside that rule. And the SEC did not appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, again, avoiding as best it could a bad decision. Now, that's agency, what I call agency deflection, an attempt to just, you know, moderate the damage. But we're also encountering it in NCLA judicial deflection. And the worst example of that, I'm going to give three, but the worst example of that is actually in the Relentless case itself, in which the district court, despite the Supreme Court ruling in Chevron, still held that the fishermen had to pay for their monitors. And it said the necessary and appropriate language in the statute allowed the Department of Commerce through its enforcement mechanisms to force the poor fishermen to pay the $700 a day costs of government monitors. And they cited something they called the default norm. Also, what we're seeing is district courts failing to follow the Axon-Cochrane ruling and still sending people back into the agency, and also district courts failing to follow the seminal decision in Jarkissi, in which courts are seeing the jury trial issue as not applying because it's a public right and keeping people in the throes of administrative power. We need to look at these issues, I think, as specific types of constitutional violations. There's regulation by enforcement, and the Jan's Pinnacle case is exactly that, where they are trying to just enact a rule and hope that, that they can create a precedent by enforcing it. Then there's also regulation by settlement. And another thing Jan had mentioned in earlier discussions was that they had really pressed Pinnacle to settle. And the beauty part of a settlement from the SEC's point of view is you are gagged for life. You cannot discuss or challenge the validity of any charge made against you. Now, NCLA is challenging that at the U.S. Supreme Court even as we speak. But the problem with regulation by settlement is you build a portfolio of precedents that then get cited to various people who are charged by agencies, and they settle, and you've got a precedent that binds them, and they can't even talk about it. Then there's regulation by extortion, and that was cited in a really interesting and important footnote in the Axon-Cochrane state case, rather, by the concurrence of Justice Gorsuch. Justice Gorsuch asked, how many people can afford to carry a case all the way to the end, noting that Michelle Cochrane had to fight for 7 years. And then he says, and this is a quote, aware too that few can outlast or outspend the federal government, agencies sometimes use this as leverage to extract a settlement that they could not lawfully obtain any other way. And he cites Philip Hamburger, who founded NCLA, who calls it regulatory extortion, and also a really interesting article by Douglas Ginsburg, in part having to do with antitrust settlement, the culture of consent, noting that consent decrees create potential for an enforcement agency to extract from parties under investigation commitments well beyond what the agency could obtain in litigation. So I think the valuable lesson of Jan's great victory in Pinnacle, and also Axon, I think, demonstrated the same kind of fortitude, is that you need to resist unlawful exercise of agency power. And I think I congratulate Jan on her great outcome. And I think there's this new category, even beyond regulation by extortion, I call it regulation by exaction, where in the remand on Loper-Bright, what the district court is saying is not only do you have to be regulated, but we will make you pay for it. And the same holds true in the CAT. In the CAT, there is no congressional appropriation at all to set up that giant monitoring system that violates our Fourth Amendment rights every day. But the SEC doesn't even pay for it out of its budget. They exact the payment from the industry SROs to pay the $1 billion costs of surveilling Americans. Now, think about that for a moment. They have created an LLC, they claim is private, that runs the government surveillance operation. It imposes a unlegislated multi-billion-dollar deadweight tax on investing in America and exposes Americans to theft and security breaches that are inherent in a centralized database, setting aside the Fourth Amendment problems. So we have a real problem with regulatory overreach, and it is only in cases where clients like Pinnacle or Axon fight the agency that you get these wins. And then you, what happens? The agency says, "Oh, never mind."
Yeah, but Peggy raises a really interesting point. You know, I think one of the things that was really shocking to me, and then not shocking at the same time, is of all of the mutual fund complexes that are subject to the liquidity rule, the SEC chooses this small fund hidden up in Syracuse, New York, with, you know, that no one's ever heard of, that is largely invested in the upstate New York economy, and really just very small private companies in upstate New York to try to stimulate that economy through the use of this fund. That's who they pick on. Yet when they go to amend the rule, they make clear that there's over 245 other funds that are misapplying the liquidity rule. So therefore, the rule needs to be amended. And I'm sure if you dug down, those allegedly misapplying it were, you know, the BlackRocks, the Fidelities, the large asset managers in this country. But the SEC wouldn't sue them. The SEC sued Pinnacle and its independent trustees. And, you know, it's important because, one, that's not that's not how the government should be operating. And I think there's a real question. When the government knows that it has done something wrong, in particular, improperly promulgated a rule that clearly is not within its statutory mandate, it really has an obligation to fix that rule because it is imperiling an entire industry that is now suffering under the weight of that rule that should not even be on the books. So it's a larger problem, but it's one that's coming up a lot. And the second thing I would say is, as to this, courts not necessarily following the Supreme Court or where the law is going, I agree. We had a very, very good judge in the Northern District that took the case seriously. And when he saw that rule challenge, I think he waited to see how the Supreme Court was going to rule and then ordered rebriefing on it. And that was unique. And we were grateful that we had that judge. But the D.C. District Court just did a similar thing where a challenge was lodged to the SEC's ability to revoke licenses and whether under jarcossy that can happen administratively or does it have to happen in federal district court. And the D.C. District Court opinion was, well, no other court has said that's wrong, so I'm not going to be the first. Now, if that's not kicking the can down the road, I don't know what is. But there is an absolute question, especially when that judge is sitting in a circuit, the D.C. Circuit, that decided in a case some number of years ago called Johnson, SEC versus Johnson, that a 102E bar for an accountant, so removing somebody from practicing before the commission as an accountant, is a penalty. So if a bar is a penalty, then under jarcossy, the bar cannot be decided by the commission. It has to be decided by a federal district court judge. So there are open questions there that can be challenged because, to Peggy's further point, there's settlement bars all the time. Every day at the SEC, there are settlement bars. And of course, settlements are not the law, but they do send a message to folks about how the SEC wants to interpret the law. But of course, now, post-Loperbright, that's not something the court should be really relying on at all.
Yeah, so lots of great issues out on the table. I want to hit a few of them, including some that were in the chat. So, you know, regulation by settlement, Peggy, they brought up a couple of things. One, when I was on the commission, right, when a staff would present a case to the commission. So the way it works is the staff prepares a recommendation to the commission and the commission has to authorize an action, whether it's a settlement or whether it's filing in court, whether it's administrative procedure or whether it's administrative proceeding or whether it's in federal district court. And the staff, when I was there, the staff was always taken aback because I said, I scrutinize settlement recommendations more than I do authorizations of filing in court. And they were like, why is that? And I'd say, well, if you are confident enough, and this is where I bring the trial lawyers in, Jan, like you used to be, and I say, if you're confident enough to make this case, explain to me why you're confident, and a fact finder will, you know, make a decision on that. But settlements, like to Peggy's point, they set precedents. They're not supposed to, but they do. And the staff would come to me and say, well, it's just a settlement, so you should just go along with it. And I say, no. This is the, you know, the power of the federal government coming after folks. And it not only sets precedent for that particular one, but we also had to be on guard in the litigation release for rulemaking by litigation release. Like sometimes there would be things snuck in there that would be a determination on something on a rule that was not in particular in the rule. And, you know, law firms read through these things like crazy, right? And there's no notice and comment on things that affect me just because simply maybe Peggy's, you know, firm decided to settle with the SEC. On rulemaking by extortion and rulemaking by enforcement, there's a question in the chat. There's two things I want to get to here. One was, the one question is, would legislation providing for attorney fee awards to the prevailing regulatory party help avoid regulation by extortion? So, you know, loser pays sort of thing, right? And then another person brings up, the SEC is also engaged in rulemaking by giving speeches or rulemaking by staff interpretations, right? I'm thinking of, you know, Staff Accounting Bulletin 121 that was issued under Chairman Gensler, which made it effectively uneconomic for banks to engage with crypto in any way. They made an accounting interpretation that said that if banks are touching crypto in any way, they had to bring those risks onto their balance sheet, even if they were just customer ones. So effectively, he was promulgating not only securities law, but banking law in that case. Now, Commissioner Ueda, when he was acting chairman, issued SAB 122, which actually, you know, got rid of that. But I'd love to hear your guys' views on, you know, sort of SEC paying attorney's fees or regulation by speeches or interpretations.
Well, I think that what Loper Bright and Relentless did was articulate that you have to find authority for what the agency is doing in a statute, and that the agency's attempt to use these other devices, and I named three or four of them, you've certainly added to them, and we all know about regulation by guidance. That should come to an end under the logic of the decision in Loper Bright. I do think attorneys fee shifting is an effective thought. I have had little luck with that in other contexts. So I would point out that I think judges are very used to the American rule and parties bearing their own costs, and it can be very difficult to get attorney's fees. The Equal Access to Justice Act is very often observed in the breach rather than in its the terms of the statute. So it would have to be a strong fee-shifting kind of rule or law. It'd have to be a law. But yes, if it was well done, I think it would curb some of these abuses.
Yeah. Jan?
Yeah, I agree. We did raise that on behalf of the independent trustees in my case. In other words, to Peggy's point, the Equal Access to Justice Act, that allows smaller parties under a certain net worth to go after the government for attorney's fees that they incurred if the government was not, and here's the key phrase, substantially justified in their position. I, you know, worked at the Department of Justice for a number of years where I defended EJIA actions on behalf of the government. They're very difficult for parties to win because of that language. Like, what is substantially justified? Was the SEC substantially justified in promulgating that rule? Well, yes, the commissioners voted for it. So clearly there was some review of that rule. It's a bipartisan commission. And, you know, it was passed and promulgated by the commission. So that would have been a difficult task. Nonetheless, I did remind the SEC that my two clients were EJIA eligible. And And often when they walk away from these cases, dismiss them with prejudice, you have to agree that you will waive the right to assert an EJIP claim against the FTC. So they are cognizant of it, but, you know, it doesn't, it's just very difficult. I want to go to the authority point that Peggy raised just for a minute, because we have a question in from the audience about the 40 Act provision granting the FTC general rulemaking authority and why it's not broad enough to allow the FTC to prevail. This came up because the FTC will always try to justify its rulemaking under, quote, the general rulemaking provision. So there's a couple of arguments there. One, that general rulemaking provision under the 40 Act 38A basically says you can only promulgate rules if they are consistent with the remainder of this title. So in other words, they have to be permitted by the title. The general rulemaking section does not give you authority to make any rule you want. And I argued this, and I had to go back to the legislative history from 1940, where I pulled out committee comments saying, we are including this provision not to expand rulemaking beyond the rulemaking grants already in the statute. So it is actually was addressed by Congress in 1940. And even though legislative history is limited, if you're using it to support what the plain language of the statute says, the courts consider it, including the Supreme Court. And they did so in the Buntrock case. And we cited that as support for why this particular legislative history was important. But the FTC will always use that general rulemaking, and every single rule that's been struck down, they've tried it, and the courts have had it said essentially the same thing. If general rulemaking meant that you can do whatever you want, we've completely lost the idea that you are limited in your rulemaking based on Congress. Otherwise, what that would mean is the FTC could just rewrite the statute as it sees fit, and that's not the intent.
Yeah, so let me stay on that. So as you mentioned, you know, the FTC promulgated the liquidity rule in 2016. It was bipartisan, and which I was a member of the commission at the time, and I voted for the rule. And let me just, for the record, sort of explain why. So we got the rule was first proposed, and there were a number of problems with it. It was overly burdensome and unworkable. And so I worked with fellow commissioners on trying to make it more workable and less burdensome. We actually, during the public comment process, we had the failure of the Third Avenue Fund, which was a distressed debt fund, and people thought it was involving high yield stuff. And we actually made some changes based upon that, because if the proposed rule had been in place, when that actually happened, it would have actually potentially exacerbated the problem it was trying to solve, which the idea is you want to make sure that funds have enough liquidity to be able to redeem their securities, right, in the event of a large market movement. And they were actually, by providing a little bit of slack, there were some funds that were actually able to take on some more of the classified illiquid funds temporarily and then be in accordance with the new rule going forward. Now, when I went back in preparing for this webinar, I'm like, did I have any concerns about the SEC's authority? And when I went back and looked at my opening statement, I was reminded that, in fact, I did. And I put in there that I wasn't sure that the SEC actually had authority to do this, and was reminded that I had conversations with the general counsel's office. And Jan, to your point, they kept pointing to general authority in here, right, that was there, right? And so, you know, as you also pointed out, we were in a Chevron deference world. And so I had to make a judgment call at that point, and I decided to, you know, defer to the general counsel's office on this one. At the time, there were no issues. You know, I always look at, you know, commissioners really, really, really look at the public comment file. And going back and looking at that again, there weren't a lot of legal arguments here. In fact, you know, the industry was fine with it. They were already kind of, there was industry practice already managing liquidity risk. There were some policy decisions in terms of how you do that sort of thing or whatever. So I just want to mention that in terms of, you know, historical context in that. So, you know, now fast forward, right, we're in a post-Loper world. And so now you can have challenges to those. So I want to, for both of you, I want to bring in another case that I think, is doesn't always get the attention that it deserves, which is the Corner Post case. And so, Jan, you said you brought the original case in 2023, which is 7 years after the rule was promulgated in 2016, which is beyond the sort of default 6 years. There's kind of people were operating, oh, you need to bring a case within a particular set of time after the rule was promulgated. But Corner Post changed the game. And Corner Post with decision along with Loper Bright, I think, is very, very powerful. Talk to us about how Corner Post helped you in making your arguments.
Yeah, I agree. I think Corner Post did change the calculus. I think Corner Post, Loper Bright, and Jarkissi are the trifecta of cases that now are going to guide most of what the agency does or should be guiding it, and it certainly should be guiding the defense bar in how we approach the commission. So, right, Corner Post basically said under the APA, there's a 6-year statute of limitations from the time you are impacted by a rule to bring your case. So these individuals were impacted by the rule in 2016. However, they were sued in an enforcement action. And Corner Post, even though, and this is how the Supreme Court is in tune with the idea that if you don't tell the government what they're supposed to do, they won't do it. So even though the issue in Corner Post had nothing to do with an enforcement action, okay, necessarily, what happened, the Supreme Court gratuitously adds into the Corner Post decision that this 6-year statute of limitations does not apply if you are sued in an enforcement action by an agency under a rule that's improperly promulgated. Why did they say that? Because they had to, right? Because otherwise the agency would say it's 6 years for everybody, even in an enforcement action. And the court was clear to say, you in an enforcement action, you can challenge the rule for 300 years if that's what it takes, right? So that's what we relied on. We got absolutely no pushback from the FTC on that argument at all.
Yeah, no.
Corner Post is very, very important. I just would note that Judge Edith Jones in the Fifth Circuit, in a dissent before Corner Post was decided, pointed out that a rule that is unauthorized by law doesn't become authorized by the mere passage of time.
Yeah. Exactly.
So Peggy, you mentioned the Consolidated Audit Trail, which was originally promulgated in 2012, in which that was before I got to the commission, so I wasn't there for this one, which basically directed the SROs, the self-regulatory organizations, exchanges, to come up with an NMS plan on that. And you're 12 years later, still looking at potentially challenging the rule. And that's been through a number of fits and starts in terms of, you know, in 2012, it was done. They came back with a plan later. And years later, came up with a cap provider. That cap provider is no longer there. Now FINRA is taking it over. So how does Corner Post factor in here in terms of challenging the Consolidated Audit Trail?
Well, exactly as Corner Post points out, you don't get a sort of a challenge-free zone just because you've done it for long enough. And in fact, there's a wonderful body of law that says, if something is unauthorized, unlawful, unconstitutional, just because someone has not brought a challenge and the agency says, well, we do this all the time, that does not validate what is an invalid rule, and it has to be the case. And that's a very important concept for us to, in they're concerned about administrative power or are defending cases brought by administrative agencies to understand that we do it all the time is not an answer. The gag rule being really one of the most outrageous examples of that. They've been doing it for 50 years. It still is unconstitutional, and it's an unconstitutional condition, and they need to stop doing it. But in the CAT, they have no authorization whatsoever under any statute to create this massive database. And so West Virginia versus EPA comes into play because that would be a major question that only Congress could decide and appropriate funds for. And those are completely missing in the CAT. And people's savings, their retirement savings, their college savings are terribly at risk. Their Fourth Amendment rights are being violated. And not even Congress could have this kind of mass collection of data without any suspicion of wrongdoing. That violates the Fourth Amendment, as Attorney General Barr has noted. It implicates Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Also, your First Amendment rights of association, to the extent that that material starts to allow the government to know how people invest. Commissioner Peirce wrote a very persuasive and very compelling series of speeches or opinions about why the CAT violates those core principles of individual autonomy, individual liberty, and our rights of association. So just because the SEC passed a rule way back in 2012 does not insulate it from subsequent review by courts. And we're confident that we don't even need Corner Post to prevail on that, but it certainly supports that, and it's a great decision that will allow people to challenge unauthorized agency power.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me how much sort of what the CAT is supposed to be has changed dramatically since then, right? People forget the original sort of idea of CAT was that we had a flash crash in 2010. And the idea was, can you have a consolidated audit trail of the trades, just the prices and those sorts of things, without any personally identifiable information in there, any of the other sort of stuff, as a way to gather the information to look at those things. Now, we can argue whether that is, you know, in accordance with the statutory authority and stuff. But now it had moved beyond, way beyond that, to get at a lot of these due process questions and stuff. So now
Corner Post is interesting. It's a case that keeps on giving for me. Every time I go back, I see something new in there that I didn't see before. One of the things I think folks should focus on for Corner Post, there's a whole section of that opinion where the court discusses the idea that in other words, the 6-year is a general default statute of limitation if the enabling statute under which the rule is promulgated includes a different statute of limitations, that's what you follow. However, the court recognizing that many statutes do contain that information, sometimes sometimes it's very limited. It could be 60 days. The court said, we just want to note that many of those statutes, i.e., all of the federal securities laws, were written and passed before 1948. Okay, so before we started to recognize the APA and a right to challenge those. So that means if those statutes contain a statute of limitations that might be less than 6 years, I think the court is giving sort of a nudge, hey, somebody should start looking at this because there's an inconsistency there. And it should be addressed. And that is definitely the case in the 33 Act, the 34 Act, and both 40 Acts. And if you read those closely, they don't all have the same statute of limitations in terms of how it's worded. And I think there's an avenue there to expand the 6 years to much of the federal securities laws.
Yeah. So let's get to a practical matter here. So Jan, you know, as you said, the rule is still in place. The liquidity rule is there, right? And, you know, the SEC There's a number of different paths that it could do. One, it could just say, you know what, they could vote and say, look, we'll just take the rule back and pretend it never happened, right? And that has consequences. Two, another possibility is they go to Congress and get explicit authority and say, we think this is important enough. We want the authority to make their case and try to get it promulgated and try to get it enacted. And then they could just say, you know what, why don't we just leave it on the books and we promise we were not going to enforce this thing, right? What in terms of when you think about sort of in a post Loper world, Loper relentless world, when we're starting to, you know, there's potentially more wins here. How should the commission think about what to deal with the rules that are on the books? Is it a facts and circumstances? Like, you know, you can make the argument, hey, there's settled expectations. The industry's kind of there on this. Is that a good enough argument, or there are other things? How do you think about that? And Peggy, then I'll get your views on it.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I think that the SEC definitely wanted to avoid yet another rule being struck down in a single year when they dismissed this case with prejudice entirely. That was their choice to do. I don't think it's appropriate for them to keep a rule on the books if they honestly believe that rule is not properly promulgated. They are the federal government. It's their obligation to take it off the books. However, I think it's interesting, and one of the big arguments we had in this case that I thought was the most powerful is that the SEC went for 75 years without promulgating a liquidity rule. And in 1992, 24 years before they promulgate the liquidity rule, the Investment Management Division of the SEC comes out with a report at the request of then Chairman Breeden, who incidentally now current chairman was counsel to during the time that report was written. And that report says mutual funds have 7 days to redeem investors. That 7-day requirement, while on the books and would be a securities law violation if you can't redeem, presents a problem for investors. And to protect them, we should promulgate a liquidity rule. However, Chairman, we do not have the authority under the Investment Company Act to actually promulgate a liquidity rule because the Act does not give us that rulemaking authority. In black and white, it's a public document. It exists. When the SEC makes a determination at a time when they're not in an enforcement action, they're not trying to support a rulemaking, and they're not trying to convince a judge as to a litigation position, their words at that time are going to appear to a court to be more thoughtful, genuine, and on point. When the SEC comes in 24 years later and says, we have the authority that 24 years ago we said we didn't have, that's going to be a problem. And there are a number of cases before the Supreme Court and other circuits where judges have said that. When you are taking a public position for 75 years and suddenly now a statute has authority that you never thought it had, that's going to work against you. But to add to that, what the commission did in 1992 was it drafted the legislation that it believed it needed to promulgate a liquidity rule and gave that to the commission so that they could go to Congress and get the statute amended. So in 1992, the commission knew exactly what it needed to do, but in 2024, it failed in that respect. And that's a problem. That's a failure of the agency to recognize that there are clearly three branches of government, and we as the SEC are not in all three.
And I would argue that it's a failure of the general counsel's office in 2016 not to tell me about that they had already made that determination that was there. I mean, that's the problem is so many of these things they have done, and it's not made available to folks to see that stuff. Now, to your point, it's this is so-called red book that was out there, and it is a public document. You can find it, I believe, on the SEC historical website, but you can find it.
Yeah, it's also on Westlaw, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a statement of the agency that has been around for decades.
Yeah. Peggy?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more that agencies and general counsels and actually commissioners too need to understand if there's a reason why a rule is it by their own judgment, not lawful or must, not one they could enforce or win a case in court. They shouldn't engage in this deflection, which we're seeing in the CAT. I gave you a lot of different examples of where the agency just tries to duck the problem and avoid a decision on it. That's we all of us, as lawyers, take an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and we have the responsibility that if we do think that a rule is unlawful or unauthorized by statute, it should be vacated or taken off the books. So I think that's really, Jan made a detailed, good argument as to why general grants of authority don't confer additional and new authority. That is, of course, the holding of West Virginia versus EPA. I think there needs to be more governmental attention to what those cases hold. And if they, in fact, if agencies are trying to act outside of their authority or read new powers into old statutes, that is where courts principally, but also those acting within the agencies needs to step in and say, stop, wait, we don't have this authority, just as they did in 1994. I think there's also a grave need for some academic work in this space, and particularly what I would love to see is an academic empirical study of the duration and costs that coerce settlement from these parties, because as Justice Gorsuch says, very few people can outlast and outspend. Axon spent over $22 million. Mark Cuban spent far in excess of what the SEC was charging him with to win a total exoneration. If there could be an empirical study of the costs that people go through in terms of being stuck in these quagmires for years and years. Michelle Cochran, it was 7 years. Ray Lucia, it was 8 years and counting.
Brad Garlinghouse from Ripple said it cost him over $100 million.
Nobody can afford this. And so then they settle and they're gagged as a requirement. And then the SEC says, well, you consented to be gagged. Nonsense. And we need to expose that nonsense, that agencies are abusing their power, they're imposing unconstitutional conditions upon settlements that people are forced to enter into. And getting the data of how long people have to wait in the administrative, my colleague Russ Ryan has this wonderful expression of what happens to people when they spend 6, 8, 10 or more years in the clause of the administrative state. He calls it the Hotel California.
Yeah.
So you can check out, but you can never leave. And, you know, it's funny, but it's actually tragic. And, you know, just as an example, Axon, even having won and having the FTC withdraw their case, they are still facing shareholder suits brought on the basis of the withdrawn merger 13 years ago. And it's you know, what these unlawful exercises of agency power do to Americans and to companies is really has far-reaching implications on these are life-altering prosecutions. I mean, if you listen to the stories of Michelle Cochran or Ray Lucia, their life is never the same again. And we have to be attentive to gather data about and write and litigate to protect Americans from these unlawful exercises of power.
Yeah. And also for the record, so I was at the commission when we heard the Lucia case on appeal. Commissioner Dan Gallagher and I both dissented. The majority of the commission decided to uphold what the administrative law judge said. We said that it should not. We dissented on that. There were also questions of constitutional law raised on that. In that case, it was the appointments clause. And the majority of the commission weighed in and said, well, of course it's constitutional. And we said, no, that's to be settled by Article III federal judges, and happy to see that moving forward.
That was a great That was a great dissent, Mike. And yeah, you also noted that the ALJ made up a rule out of whole cloth.
Oh, right.
That's the direct quote.
I forgot about that particular part of the issue in that one. You think about these things are, you know, it's constant. You just need people committed to try to fight these things. Right. And one of the things and, you know, Peggy, one of the things that your firm is so great at is actually reading what commissioners say. So it matters what commissioners say. And, you know, you mentioned Commissioners Peirce and Ueda. They've been fantastic in laying out some of the legal arguments in terms of and policy arguments in terms of trying to rein in some of the power that's not used properly. So unfortunately, we're out of time. Before I turn it back to Matthew to say a couple last words in here, Jan and Peggy, I just want to thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today. It was a fantastic discussion, important ongoing issues, and it represents what the best of the Federalist Society has to offer. So very happy with today's conversation. And with that, Matthew, back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, Jan, and Peggy, for the benefit of your time today. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you very much. I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.